listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio. Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Oh my goodness, I got to see the book, and I just love it. And you should, if you got half an interest in this, you should get it because it's quite amazing. The book is called, would you believe it, Urban Beekeeping. And it's written by Parliament's beekeeper. And we're very blessed to have him with us, Cormac Farrell. Have I got your name right, Cormac?
Yeah, Farrell. But I answered all sorts of names, so it's fine.
Oh, well, you're an Australian. You got used to it, right?
That's it, pretty much.
Where does the name Cormac come from?
It's Irish, actually. It means son of the raven in Gaelic. So my dad's Irish. Came out here as a you know, the ten pound pom program, but he wasn't a pom. He was Irishman. He snuck in into that program. Came out, met my mum. Yeah, that's how it worked.
Good. Now, you're a beekeeper. How did you get into beekeeping first of all? This, by the way, to jump to the end, this is about keeping bees in the heart of a city, which I didn't think was possible. And it's actually about something more fundamental than that. It's about a philosophical shift about how we see urban design and how we see cities. Because we think of prettying cities up by planting a few trees and having a bit of green grass. But what Cormac is teaching us is that it only actually really works if they're functioning as an ecosystem. And that to me was a bombshell revelation, Cormac. An absolute bombshell revelation.
It's something I really love doing because I've sort of been working in this space for about 20, 25 years now. So originally, in terms of how I got into beekeeping, I originally got into native bees, which again is something most people aren't really particularly aware of, but we have thousands of native bees all through our environment, including through our cities. And as a forester, they are the key pollinators for a lot of the native plants that we work with. So we were very aware of them. And then it's about a bit more than 12 years ago now, my partner and I, we bought a house. There was an apricot, beautiful, beautiful big apricot tree. And my partner loves apricots, and it was not setting fruit. So she said, right, you know, you're the botanist, mate, go fix that. Sure enough, it was all stunted fruit. It was pretty easy to spot that it wasn't being pollinated. So I went, all right, well, pollinator for fruit trees is honeybees. So I'll get a honeybee hive. And that sort of started the whole journey. So it was actually, it was not about the honey. It was always about the function that bees do, their real function, which is in fact to produce pollination, to produce the fruit and flowers and vegetables that we live off and we eat.
Back then, your first foray, where did you get your hive and bees from?
I got them from another beekeeper. So I joined the local bee club, which is, it's kind of been this incredible transformation as well in parallel. So there was I went to the first meeting, I think there was about 30 people there, and most of them relatively like old-time beekeepers, which is fantastic because my mentor, she was a third-generation beekeeper and sort of showed me the ropes. And she was living in the city, but she was actually, her family were commercial beekeepers. So she had been raised in this environment and was a brilliant, brilliant mentor for me. But then I bought what's called a nucleus hive, which is like a mini starter colony, put in the backyard, and away they went. And it was kind of fantastic. It was kind of funny. I talked to all of my neighbors, and at the time, Canberra did have a shortage of bees, and a lot of our plants, especially a lot of backyard vegetable gardens, were not being properly pollinated. So I sort of somewhat sheepishly talked to my neighbors and said, look, you know, I'm thinking of putting a hive in. Is it okay? And they were enthusiastic. They went, oh, yeah, great. Where are you putting it? We sort of, the back corner there. And they went, yeah, great. And they all moved their veggie patches sort of next to the hive, basically, on their side of the fence. And we all got this fantastic yield then from then on in. We got this fantastic yield of fruit and vegetables throughout our garden. So they were pretty happy about the situation. I thought they would be sort of against it a little bit, but they really weren't. They were super enthusiastic. They were pretty happy about it.
Did you have to do much to the bees the first year, or just let them go?
You have to inspect bees to make sure that they're not picking up disease. But so there was, and I really enjoyed that. Like, I found the whole process of having bees to be the most fun. Like, again, I wasn't particularly focused on the honey, which did result in a sort of a funny thing the first time we did a harvest. But no, when you have bees in your backyard, they are substantially a wild animal, and native bees are absolutely a wild animal. So you don't have to do much at all. So especially for me, I've got a day job that I have to do, and I have responsibilities. So if we're in a really busy period, we just leave the bees to themselves. They just do. They're not like chickens. They're not like a dog or a cat that you've got to sort of look after them every day. They just look after themselves, which is kind of fantastic.
Locally, we have a Brazilian man who makes these most beautiful looking hives. I mean, they're a work of art. And his dealers, he drops them to your house. And the people that I know that have done it have got like a suburban house with a garden. And he puts the beehive up, and you actually pay him. And he gives you some amount of honey, and he keeps some, and he brands the honey as yours, right?
Oh, wow.
So you don't have to do anything. And he's actually got quite a successful part-time business, which is a pretty cool idea, right?
That is cool.
And my friend who's got the hive, well, put it this way, I got enthusiastic until I realized what it was going to cost me. And then I thought, oh, I'm not paying that, right?
Yeah.
But my friend who's got the bees, his favorite thing in the world is to sit on the veranda after work and watch the bees.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely influenced my management of the Hives of Parliament, because it's this super, as you know, it's this super high-pressure building. People are leading these incredibly scheduled high-pressure lives. And we realized that people early on, we just sort of had the bees in the garden. We thought this would be fun. We'll produce some honey for the kitchens, gift jars for VIPs. But we didn't think people would interact with the bees much at all. And then we realized people were actually going down next to the hives because they're just in the outer garden. You just walk up to them. And they were just sitting and watching the bees. And it is really calming to watch them work. It's really fascinating. It's really fun. And people were using it as sort of like a mindfulness to sort of just to chill out and reconnect a bit and de-stress. But it meant that I then go and do that. I go and sit near the hives and make sure they are safe to be around, that they have to be, and people often don't realize this, that they have this mental image that the bees are going to aggressively come out and attack them and chase them away. Some colonies can be like that, but most bee colonies will not do that. They will. Most colonies, you can sit near them. In fact, you should be, especially for anything that's public area, you should be able to be close to the bees. They should not react to your simply your presence.
And that's just a matter of having a well-managed hive.
It is. It's actually you change the queen. If you find the queen sets that she's not in charge, so bees are actually a democratic insect. They make all of their decisions by voting as a whole group, but the queen sets the genetics, and the genetics set how defensive they are. So if you find you've got a really defensive hive, my job, and I've had to do this, and there's actually on my Instagram, there's a video of myself and one of the other beekeepers, Siobhan, dealing with this extremely defensive hive. They were absolutely trying to rip us to pieces, and we were finding the queen, killing the queen, and putting a new queen in to sort that out. And about 2 weeks after that, the genetics started to sort of kick in as the new bees hatched out, and that hive really chilled out.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's one of the really
sort of... And you don't have to know anything about bees to be actually intrigued by them. Able to stare at them. And then as you learn a little bit about bees, I imagine it becomes even more fascinating. Again, as I read your book, I had no idea. I knew they did a wee dance to tell the hive where the flowers were, I had no idea it was done in the dark.
Yeah, I mean, this is the freakiest thing. They are doing this dance to give each other coordinates, and the angle of the dance, the number of circuits they do, gives them sort of distance and bearings. But it's all in the dark. So the honeycomb is actually their telephone system, because the other bees sense the dance by just holding onto the comb, and they can sense, okay, right there, she's dancing at this angle and she's done this many circuits, I can feel. That's why it's the waggle dance. That's why they waggle their butt, because the vibration is how the other bees can feel where she is and her orientation. But it's still absolutely amazing to me. And it's kind of one of the things I think is really funny. We imagine as humans, we're sort of this top of the food chain. And in Australia, you're not always top of the food chain, but we like to imagine we are. But then our entire society, our entire agriculture is based on a bunch of bees doing interpretive dance in the dark in a box. If they didn't pollinate our crops, we'd be dead. We'd absolutely die.
And it's a bit like if microorganisms in the soil, isn't it? It's like,
same. Like, yeah, if nitrogen fixing bacteria stopped working, we'd be absolutely dead. There's no way we could replicate that.
Mm. So I want to get into this urban thing, because that to me is the key. But by the way, do you know or recall the man that identified the dance and was able to?
Von Frisch, I think his name was.
That's right.
Yes, Carl von Frisch.
And he decoded it.
Yes. I mean, that was amazing science. I mean, that's hundreds of hours of observation. And then he's systematically tracking and going, okay, they're not just randomly, they're not just dancing for mating or anything else. To make that leap and that understanding is, I mean, he won a Nobel Prize for that.
Really?
He did. He won the Nobel Prize for decoding the bee's dance, and it was a really beautiful bit of science.
Isn't that? And, of course, it's a thing that everyone sort of knows is common knowledge, and it wasn't that long ago that no one knew.
No, this is it. We no one knew this at all. We knew they didn't just randomly buzz around the landscape. And that's one of the things I do when I'm running tours of beehives, is I get the people to stand behind the hives, and we do something called beelining. And that's where the term make a beeline comes from, because the bees go straight to the flowers because they've been given coordinates. So they just come out of the hive and they go straight, and you can see working streams of bees. There'll be, you know, some going over this way, some going over that way. And what you do as a beekeeper is how you figure out what's in the honey is you stand behind the hive and you look and you see where they're going, and then you walk the line until you hit some flowers. And it's usually not subtle, because it takes about 2 million flower visits to make a kilogram of honey. So it's not one or two flowers. You're looking for a tree in full bloom with thousands of flowers. And if it's really amazing when you're in a forest or within an urban park and there's a lot of trees flowering and the bees are really working them hard, the whole air just hums with the bees working. It's I really love it.
Let's continue.
Yep.
You had your how did you harvest your first lot of honey? Because I'm thinking of people at home always wanting to give it a go.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, oh, I could get that. How hard is it? And I could get that book and it'd get me on my way, which it will, and it will enthuse you. But when you came to do that first harvest, how did you get the honey out? Did you get yourself, or did you get someone from the club?
No, I did it myself. This is we're in the sort of the golden age of beekeeping right now. You can just look up on YouTube and you can learn a lot about most things pretty easily. So I used the spinner. So you pull all the wax caps off, you scrape them off, and you put it through this spinner that spins the frames of the honey, flings off one of the walls and collects in your chamber. And the funny thing was that we completely misjudged how much honey a hive produces. So we had like six frames, and we had lined up about a dozen jars. Now, anyone who's in beekeeping is laughing right about now, because they know that that is about sort of 60 jars worth of honey.
Wow.
So, it's huge. And it is deceptive, because honeycomb is such an incredibly efficient storage system that you don't realize how much is in there, especially when you're a newbie like I was at the time. And so you
60
spin it.
Jars. Just, and you just had a casual little hive in the backyard.
Yeah, I did. And it was an absolute debacle in that sense that honey got everywhere and we were filling up. We had to fill up all our Tupperware containers to try and get all this honey. And we filled up a saucepan at the end. And we eventually went out and bought, the next day we went out and bought a whole bunch of jars and filled up all the jars. But, yeah, look, that hives are, honeybees are incredibly productive. And it's kind of fun. But, I mean, the book, in a way, is it's not so much just for the beginners or it's not for the beginners in honeybees. It's for the people who are looking at that next level. They're moving out of their backyard now. And that's where I ended up, where I sort of moved out of my backyard.
Yes, tell us that story.
Yeah, so it is funny. Again, it's centers around my partner. So I was allowed one hive in a backyard. And then the bees swarmed onto her favorite yellow dress. So she gives me a ring and tells me in no uncertain terms, and I cannot repeat the words exactly for your listeners, but they can probably guess, basically saying,
where was the dress?
It was on the clothesline, which was near the hive. So there's this mass of bees on her favorite dress, and she knew enough about bees to know that they were going to start building comb and they were going to start basically living on the dress. So she said, get them off that dress right away. So I had to get the swarm into a hive, and I did. And she said, you're only allowed one hive at home, mate. I went, okay. So I talked to my boss, and I was in an engineering firm at the time. Actually, we still work with them in bees, Oricon, which is also a New Zealand firm. We had a big New Zealand division. Yeah. Lots of Kiwis. And we were a small regional office, and we started keeping bees on the balcony. And it sort of put the office on the map a little bit because we had honey gifts to give to our clients. And the clients absolutely loved this. And they loved the idea of, like you were saying before, you didn't realize you could keep bees in the city. I remember the first discussion with the lawyers, and they were just like, how's this going to work? Like, how can you even do this? Like, they're going to starve. Like, are they going to be okay? And I was like, no, there's actually a lot of flowers in an urban environment. And Canberra has a lot of flowers. And also other cities have these beautiful urban forests. I remember once I went to Dunedin. That is, I think, still in autumn, the most beautiful city I've ever been to.
Wow.
That cascade of colour as the trees change colour in autumn is just, it really hit me. It was actually one of the reasons, again, I sort of got into urban forestry, and this idea that we can create not just a couple of trees to pretty the place up, that we can actually create a landscape that is cohesive and functions as beautiful.
And a working ecosystem.
Exactly, yeah. So that's the next bit I started to – I'm an ecologist specialising in grassland and woodlands, but I started to do a lot of bushfire management, which in Australia is a big thing. And a lot of it was working on the urban fringes, and we still needed to create this functional urban environment that still had enough habitat for the animals and plants that were living there. But then we started the city planner started to talk to me and go, well, you're doing this on the edge to make sure that the clearance zones you're creating for bushfire protection don't interrupt that ecology. But why don't we, you know, we could actually start to do this through the whole city. I went, yeah, actually we can. If we change the species mix and make sure that something is flowering at all times and we create essentially corridors through the city, and lots of places are doing this now. It's a really popular thing, and it is absolutely fantastic. Just the other day, I had some superb parrots. I was taking the dog for a walk, and we had some superb parrots in the garden. If you look them up, they are absolutely stunning. But also, they've been badly affected by habitat clearance, and they are now using cities and urban areas to refuel, essentially, on their migration. They migrate back and forth through the landscape. But it means that at some times of the year, we have swift parrots, we've got gangangs, which are another type of parrot. They're really fun. They're really cheeky. They like being around people, which is kind of funny. And they've got these grey feathers and this bright red head. And they're really, really funny. They look a bit scruffy. They're quite funny. A bit. They look a little bit like a Kia if you put like a bright red head on it. And they got about the same attitude as a Kia.
Oh, well, we know about Kia.
They're less destructive. They are less destructive, thankfully.
So you're in this office of engineers in Canberra, which I've never been to, but I imagine it's a concrete jungle.
It is yes and no. Canberra has always been a bit unusual. We're a city of gardeners, okay, and they're always prioritised the urban forest. So we've always had a pretty big urban forest. Okay. And it's not cheap either. It's about, you know, 10 million plus per annum to run, you know, this urban forest. It's a okay. lot of work. So they wanted to get a little bit more out of it in terms of function and in terms – and also we're switching over how we grow the forest, because the one thing that is new in the urban landscape is solar panels. So people have got solar panels on their roofs now. So that means on the northern edge of roads, we're switching over the tree base from tall growing trees that were shading out the panels. We're going to lower trees. But that okay. works really well for bees, because we're going to Callistemon, the bottle brush, snow gums in our environment, which are low growing, low spreading. Red flowering gums are another one. In New Zealand, you have a whole lot of beautiful shrubs that produce really lovely honey and also nectar and resources for other native species. So it's really been a fantastic, and because it's constantly changing, because the urban forest is always being renewed, always being changed, they can't let trees get too old because they drop limbs. So you've got this renewal happening. And wow. as this rolls through the landscape over the next 30 to 50 years, this landscape will continue to develop and continue to improve its productivity.
So you're in your engineering office. You've got a hive on a balcony.
Yeah. What's that? Yeah.
So like you slide, the balcony is a big sliding door, I imagine, and you slide the door and you walk out on the balcony, and you've put a hive there.
And it was fantastic, because when the engineers, when we were working, and you know, I don't know if you've ever been in an engineering firm, you've got to do bids, you've got to do major projects. So you're busy, 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 and then you'll have a lull period. And that's when we'd say, all right, let's go have a look at the bees. I'd get myself and one of the others, we'd just over lunchtime, because it doesn't take long, and we'd just open up the hives. And because it was on a balcony with a big glass window, I could do the full inspection in my suit, but I could, you know, hold the frames up to the window. People could see the inside of the hive, and they loved it. They loved being able to see all the way inside the hive. It was a really big, active, strong hive. We ended up with two at the time. Wow. And it was really, really fun, and they really loved it. And then the whole office got involved when we did the honey harvest, when we were spinning out the honey or crushing out the honey. But we'd just basically do it after work, be a big party. We'd have beers and just chill out and put honey in jars. And then we started to invite clients along because they wanted to have a go as well. And, yeah, they just loved it. And people would bring their kids in. The kids would get to taste honey straight from the hive. And when honey is just straight fresh out of the hive and is still warm, because inside a hive is 37 degrees, it's the same as our body temperature. And it's the one, I suppose, one frustration I've got is that we still can't quite capture the flavour of that honey. We put it in the jar and it's still nice. It's still great. Single floral honeys are amazing. But there's just something extraordinary. If you ever get a chance to go with a beekeeper, it's extraordinary to taste honey absolutely fresh from the hive. It is just incredible.
So you would brand it for your engineering firm, and then you'd give a jar to a customer, a client, I guess, they'd be amazed.
Oh, yeah. And it was the brand was called Office Buzz. And it was, it was great. And we ended up having an Indigenous artist paint one of the hives and as a living piece of artwork. And then that artwork, we got permission from her to put some of that artwork on the jar, and it's this fantastic Indigenous design. It just looked incredible. So it was very well done. And our graphic design team, which would normally be working on our projects, they just did this. Again, everyone did this in their sort of their spare time, and that's how it works sort of with Parliament as well and everything else. We're all volunteers.
So we've got to get how you then – I can imagine that being a story – in the newsletter for your company around all the offices. And, it becomes a thing. But you expand it.
We did. We had to change. So, the one thing it did that was cool is it put Canberra office on the map a little bit, because we were always a little bit of a backwater, which is fine. But we ended up becoming a bit more known in the company. Obviously, people wanted the jars for their clients, the wider clients in other offices as well. So we could sort of trade favors for that. But then the big change came when we had to move offices. So we suddenly had to move offices. The landlord decided he wanted to do something else in the building. So we had to suddenly move. And the new building we ended up going to had no safe roof access, which was, given that we do building design, our engineers were sort of horrified going, this means, you know, you can't even put solar panels on this roof. It's useless. So it actually changed our design approach a little bit as well. But suddenly our bees were homeless and we had to sort of cast around and say, where can we put our bees? And we asked lots and lots of places. And about that time, the Department of Parliamentary Services in Canberra here was interested in doing something a little bit out of the box in terms of sustainability. And they started talking to us and saying it would be interesting, could be useful as a sort of a demonstration apiary here, but also would be useful because we could, you know, obviously use the honey in the kitchens and for gifts and that sort of thing. So we started talking and, you know, about 6 months later, I was putting bees into the gardens at Parliament, and I was the volunteer head beekeeper for the Australian Parliament. Now, that's 7 years ago now. We're still going. Still doing it with Oricon, actually. They still co-brand the label. It's really funny.
Funny. And your firm would love it, right?
Because they love it. Oh yeah.
You couldn't get better lobbying access or brand visibility or company visibility than doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing is that we're not really a lobbying firm. We just design and build stuff. So that was kind of, in some ways, it's probably wasted on us. It could be, I'm sure it could be you. I'm sure the lobbyists going, oh, damn, why didn't I think of that?
I bet they are. They would have employed a beekeeper just to get that access.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, what are you doing here? I'm just looking after the bees.
I'm just looking after the bees.
And, you know, the Deputy Prime Minister is sitting there chatting to you.
Yeah, that's it.
And you say, look, I've got a bone to pick with you. How far do bees range?
Oh, for honeybees, it's out to about 5 kilometres.
Hell yeah. And those little wee wings.
Those little wee wings, they are incredible flyers.
I never knew.
Yeah, they have a really good navigation. They are very, very energy efficient. They can fly forwards, backwards, in high wind. They are amazing flyers. It's no enormous surprise that there's a lot of research going on into honeybee flight and how they control and navigate. Because they're basically the next generation of drones. Sort of, it's something called biomimicry. It's a branch of engineering. Look at nature for inspiration for engineering design. But what that does is it changes how you see the landscape as a beekeeper, because everything good in the landscape is going into your food. So that mix of flowers, and it's especially where we are in an urban environment. It's not like commercial beekeeping in a forest where you're going to, for instance, the Manuka honey. You're going to stream sides and riversides that just have Manuka flowering, and that single source of florals goes into your hives. Whereas here, in an urban environment, you get what you get. And it's this constant changing, shifting mix of flavors as that environment goes into your food, which is great. But also, everything bad in the environment, that's also going in your food.
What's bad?
Pesticides, miticides, all of the pollutants that might be in the environment, they will be ending up in your honey. So it then changes how you see the landscape, because you obviously want to protect your bees. You want to see people in gardens using less pesticides and ideally bee-friendly gardening techniques. You want to see less pollution in general. Bees are very good at stripping pollution out of honey, but it hurts the bees. When we had the major fires here, the Black Summer fires, we were losing most of our foragers. So CSIRO were marking bees in a beehive, and they realised they were losing about 90% of the foragers were going out into the smoke, and they just weren't coming back. And they were able to warn me and say, hang on, we're losing all the foragers. You're basically going to have to start feeding the colonies to make sure they can regenerate.
Oh, so if you feed them...
We don't like doing it because the sugar water can go into the honey and can sort of shandy with the honey. You don't want that because it's not pure honey. But if you're not taking honey off them, and in that instance, we were definitely not taking honey off them, you would feed them and it will keep them going, but not, it's not particularly effective long-term. It's like if we just ate one thing with no other nutrients or vitamins in it. We can do it for a period of time, but it's not going to keep us alive long-term.
So when you see a worker bee out flying, and it's a she.
It's always a she.
And she is flying, every one of them are her sisters.
Yes.
Are they fertilized? They're not. They are fertile.
They are fertile.
They have a dad?
They do have a dad.
That's the drones.
That's the drones. But interestingly, the drones do not have a dad. The drones are, their genetics works completely differently to ours. An unfertilized egg turns into a male, turns into a drone. A fertilized egg turns into either a worker bee or a queen. So it means that, and this is the weird part of their genetics, a drone, a male bee, he doesn't have a father, but he does have a grandfather.
Got it. That is funny.
It is very strange.
And they go out to a flower up to 5 kilometres and gather nectar, right?
And pollen. Yeah, okay, so the nectar is their carbs and the pollen is their protein and their vitamins.
Okay. So they eat some at the flower and carry some home? Is that how it works?
No, they eat honey. So they carry the nectar back to the hive. They put the nectar into their cells and they transform it. As they're carrying it back, they're putting enzymes into it. This transforms starts transforming it into into honey, and then they fan their wings. It's sort of like not quite fermenting. It sort of cooks with the enzymes into honey. So it comes in, nectar comes in at about a 50% moisture level, and it drops down before we consider honey. It has to be below 21% water content. So as the water's being stripped out, they also add a little bit of peroxide and a few other natural acids. And that preserves the honey. So honey never goes off. The record for honey preservation is they found it in some Egyptian tombs, still perfectly fine to eat. It essentially is immortal. But
goodness me.
Yeah, a teaspoon of honey. I remember there was this really interesting stat. A teaspoon of honey has enough energy. So they eat the honey for energy. Is enough in a teaspoon of honey, there's enough to power a bee to fly twice around the world. Like, it's a super, super food for them. And they are incredibly efficient. I mean, obviously, they've got 100 million years of evolution behind them. So the honey gives them immense energy and power and fuel.
So the honey's made out of nectar. Is there pollen in it as well?
There is a little bit of pollen in it as well. A bit of pollen comes along for the ride. But most of the pollen they would collect and they turn it into something called bee bread. Now, that's a sort of a fermented bread product basically in the hive, and they feed that to the baby bees. So when they're building, as a beekeeper, if I'm looking at a hive and you see a whole bunch of beautiful sort of coloured, they've got like their saddle bags full of these beautiful coloured pollens, that means they're making baby bees because they're building up, because they need that to build their bodies. They need the pollen, they need the neck, they need the protein. If I see them carting lots and lots of pollen, that means they're doing a build-up. And then when I see them stop carting quite so much pollen and they're really just hammering, and especially if they're landing heavy, that means they're carrying a lot of nectar. They can carry their own body weight in product, which is extraordinary. Again, they're incredibly strong flyers. I could not carry my own body weight.
and fly.
And fly, yeah.
They. Where do they keep? They got wee sacks somewhere, haven't they?
Yeah, they've got something called their legs is where they keep pollen. They stick it together with some nectar, but they have a honey stomach essentially. It's like a little storage crop, like on a bird, for where they keep it before they put it into the hive. Yes, yeah, so they drink it up.
Where do they get? How do they make the wax?
The wax is made from their body. So at a certain stage of their development, so bees have a career progression. They start as a cleaner. They then move into being a nursemaid. And then they, and then after that, they start making wax. They become like an architect, and they have glands on their belly, and they produce the wax. They make it out of their bodies, and they make it from. They use the energy from honey to make wax, and it takes about 8 kilograms of honey to make 1 kilogram of wax. So it's very expensive for them to make, which is why they preserve it, they keep it, they move it around, they won't waste wax ever.
And when you spin the honey, mm-hmm. what are you doing then? You're taking the wax out.
Yeah, so you're taking the wax caps off. So when they're storing the honey long term, they've made the honey, they've evaporated all the moisture off. They then go, right, that is now honey. That cell is full of honey. They put a little cap of wax over the top. And that's when you buy honeycomb and you see all the sort of the wax sheet on top. That's that capping, what's known as cappings. Okay. To get the honey out, well, it depends. It actually depends which bee we're talking about. So to get the honey out from a honeybee hive, Apis mellifera, we use a special fork to sort of scrape open the caps, and we then spin the honey out or crush the honey out. We also keep native stingless bees at Parliament. They have a totally different architecture, nest architecture system. They're known as sugar bag, and you'll see photos in the book. And they're little bags of resin, which the resin permeates the honey and also makes it very strongly antibacterial. But those little resin pots, we get a fork. you just get a fork. And you just poke them open, and the honey's quite runny, and you just turn the honey chamber upside down after you've poked all the holes open, and it just runs out. You run it through a sieve, and you've got native stingless bee honey in your jar.
What do you do when you spin the wax? It separates the wax out. What do you do with the wax?
Oh, the wax, I render it down. So I actually render it into cakes, and that's used for – the wax is really, really useful for us. Candles, obviously, that was the original – that's the reason religious orders used to keep bees for the candles. It's also used in cosmetics. And at Parliament, we actually have a line of soap with the wax. Mm. So yeah, lip balm. Lip balm's a really popular one as well. I think
so. It's a fat.
No, it's a wax. It's a wax. So like it's not like a fat at all. It's a different. Yeah, it's chemically a wax is a wax. It's basically sheets of hydrocarbons with weak hydrogen bonds between them. So it forms this. Well, they sort of slide across everything and coat things. Furniture polish. Yeah.
I got very bad hay fever for the first time in my life last year. I was told that I should eat local honey, but get the honeycomb and eat the wax.
Yeah, because – and this is really fun. This is really new. And as a scientist, I was always a little bit dubious about this. People said, oh, no, local honey. And I said, well, there's not a lot of proof. And just recently some scientists did some research looking at if you take an antihistamine and you take a teaspoon of raw honey, will that do anything? And it turns out it does. It turns out it significantly improves the improves the effect of the medication. So you're still taking medicine, you're still taking the antihistamine to control your symptoms, but honey seems to have this additive effect that it really, really does improve. And look, the honeycomb, if it's in honeycomb, it's guaranteed to be raw honey, so that's why it's working. The other one, you can get raw honey, which it just means it hasn't been heat treated. And that's what we produce at Parliament. So it just takes longer. So it will often be a little bit more expensive. But it means it's got all the pollens. What we don't know is it the pollens that you're eating with the local honey, which I think it probably is, and it's training your immune system, this is actually good, don't worry about it, or is there something intrinsic to honey? Because we know honey is anti-inflammatory and antibacterial. So this is the next step. So this initial study is just to say, does this work? Yes, no. The answer is yes. Now we've got to figure out how does it work? Why is it working? Is there a particular type of honey that would be better or worse?
Is there a proper way to eat honey, or can you just eat it however you like it?
However you like it. One of the things I do when I do sort of food events, because that's another part of the book, is like how to use food to sort of connect people to their landscape. I get honey from all over the world and all over the country. I try and get honey from – there's only one honey that I don't let people sample at events. That's the – I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called red honey or mad honey. That's a hallucinogenic honey.
Oh.
For obvious reasons, we don't drug people at the events.
That might help Parliament.
Yeah, it's funny, the Nepalese Tibetans use it as to assist with meditation. It's quite interesting.
And it's a red honey.
Yeah, it's a red honey.
Is it
honey.
The bee that's special or the flowers?
It's both. So it comes from a particular type of bee called Apis dorsata, which is the giant honeybee. We don't keep them in hives. They're fairly aggro, actually. But also the flower, it's actually mostly the flowers. So the Tibetans and also the Turks have this. And Nepal, Tibet, and Turkey have these rhododendron forests. And rhododendron has a particular toxin in its pollen called granulotoxin. Enough of this gets in the honey when the bees collect off a rhododendron forest that you get this red color, which is how they tell it's the real stuff. But also it puts a cap on your heart rate. So it actually means you can't – some people take it for anxiety because it means, you know, when you have a panic attack, your heart rate spikes really, really hard and sort of runs away. It's an awful feeling. And this puts a hard cap on it, and your heart can't go faster than a certain level. The risk is if you take too much, it sets your heart rate to zero and you die. No one's ever died, but people have gotten very sick. So you have to be, you know, you can't just go crazy. But in terms of how do you eat honey, it's all different ways. I love it in my coffee. I actually have it as a sweetener in my coffee. I also love trying different honeys. Actually, just at the book launch, one of my friends gave me a type of honey that had been mixed with lemon myrtle, which is a local native herb here. Beautiful. I think I'll definitely have them on toast. So I love it on toast. I love it on crumpets. Crumpets are probably one of my favourite ways to have honey.
Porridge?
Yeah, porridge. Porridge is pretty good. The other one, buckwheat honey on pancakes, definitely. Yes, buckwheat honey is really is nutty, nutty flavour and really cool.
When you're having bees in an urban environment like Parliament or your office, does the honey vary season to season?
100%, yes, absolutely. And it's really one of the fun things we do at Parliament is there's an executive chef there in charge of all things kitchen. And the first thing I do every season is I give a little sample to him and his team. And watching a professional chef, a really good one, taste honey is really extraordinary because they're not just sort of going, oh, yeah, that's honey. You can see the wheels turning. You can see them, and then they start bouncing ideas off each other, going, oh, I'm getting caramel notes, or I'm getting like a slight backburn on the back of my throat. There's all these different
They're like flavors. Wine tasters.
They are like wine tasters. And actually there are honey sommeliers. One of my friends, Jess Locatieri, she is and New Zealand's got honey sommeliers as well. And they match honey to food. And that's what these folks are doing. They're going through and going, right, okay, we can turn this. The one year they turned it into a panna cotta. So they put the honey and infused the honey through a panna cotta. That was incredible. Another year they made, this year actually they've made ice cream. So they've mixed it with vanilla, a vanilla flavor, and they've made ice cream that they buy in the cafe. It's really, and a really strong honey flavor came through really strongly. The other one they did was they did macarons. They did honey-infused macarons. That was cool.
Tell me, you could imagine, like, I read your book and I just wanted to go into an office and set up a hive because it was so cool, right?
That's good.
It's so wonderful, right? And, like, it's just that, but there's a deeper philosophical issue here, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. It's how we live, you know, and how we live in our cities is that, I think as you said the other day, you said earlier, like growing up, people had this perception that a city should just be a concrete, was just a concrete jungle. But it's not, and it doesn't have to be. We can actually change entirely how, and I think this is something that a lot of New Zealand cities get right. But a lot of other cities over the world are now changing. And there's a couple of drivers for this. A lot of it is the fact that we do have climate change and we are getting increasing heat waves. Heat waves are the most dangerous part of climate change. They kill the most numbers of people, hands down. But they're also, trees are extraordinary. They're an incredibly powerful way to get around this major effect of climate change, because they cool surfaces. So around under an urban tree canopy in the city, the pavements will be 10 degrees cooler if they're shaded by trees. And it's because it's not just the shade, it's also the trees are, because as they breathe out moisture. So they're actually cooling the air around them. And increasingly, cities all over the world sort of putting trees in, putting green infrastructure in, and living infrastructure, as it's called, to basically cool the cities down. But at the same time, the book is about, we should do that. We are doing that because we have to. But at the same time, let's make it function. Let's actually make it produce food.
And if you're in an engineering office or in parliament and you're having a quiet time enjoying the bees, you start looking around your environment, which hitherto, because you're busy, you've never noticed.
Mm.
And you start saying to yourself, oh, where are those bees going? Yeah. And you start thinking about the living environment around your office, around your parliament, around your house, and you're connected to it because your bees are accessing it and you're having it on your toast.
Exactly.
And it's not this go to the shop and buy a jar of honey.
Yeah.
You're harvesting it. And I have a thing. And the example would be, here in New Zealand, we have, say, wonderful beech forests. And then someone will be building a hotel or landscaping something, and the architects and the council all go nuts, and they've got to plant beech trees. And you see these 2-metre beech trees planted out, and they're staked, and they're sitting in a lawn, and the lawn is mowed. And it's nothing like a beech forest, right?
No, exactly. I mean, this is the
It's this idea that a forest is a lot more than the tree.
Mm. It's a whole community, you know.
Yeah, and I'm always troubled by that, because I say to myself, they can even go to the ridiculous thing of planting beech trees in a row.
And nature doesn't like straight lines. Yeah.
No, and I live in Queenstown, Central Otago.
Oh,
and
nice.
They have a place called Millbrook, which is actually laid out. You couldn't do it now under the planning laws. It's laid out like an English garden with beautiful introduced species. And in autumn, it looks fantastic, right?
Mm.
I go to other places and it's beech trees, which are lovely because they're native, but they haven't done it in a way that's functional to me. And not in a way, you're directly confronting that by making the city and the landscape work as an interconnected thing.
Yeah, you're trying to look at what is the surrounding environment? What is coming in from the surrounding environment in terms of plants, animals, and also resources?
Yes.
And then, you know, in the same way that an ecosystem works, that the energy flow comes in and the nutrient flows come in, and that turns it into something. And then that then flows out into somewhere else and something else. So looking at that as the city as an interconnected system, it's not about just putting in, like you said, just putting in some beech trees in a lawn and saying, well, that's near enough to a forest. It's actually, what was that forest connected to originally?
Yes.
We don't have to sacrifice. Yes, we have to live. And, you know, to make an omelet, you've got to break some eggs. Our cities do have an impact on the environment. But increasingly, for instance, the concrete drains that used to be stormwater, they are all being replaced now because they're dangerous. You know, when the rain falls, you get this big pulse flood. That is, if anyone's, you know, if kids are playing in that concrete drain, it's actually really risky. So increasingly, we're now creating constructed wetlands that they don't just absorb the pulse flow, they also clean the water.
Mm.
Rooftops, like one of my favorite apiaries, in fact, my favorite apiaries are, which I'll be on later today, they are the tall buildings, like the tops of tall buildings. We're 7-8 stories up, and we've got these apiaries and gardens up there. But those gardens also absorb that pulse flow and stop it from, and they filter the water. So you've got cleaner water coming out of the city, but you've also got some production happening, some plants, some nutrients, some nectar, a whole lot of stuff that is really good for the environment. So we can absolutely engineer this living infrastructure to make a really functional ecosystem.
And that's wonderful. That's the bit that I love, the bee stuff. I love the hives. I love the idea of it. I love the idea of in the office and you have this sort of meditation. But then I love the idea of an underpinning philosophy of urban design and all urban use, which is just looking at the same thing differently, in a different way. I enjoyed the story about how your engineering firm was troubled and wondered what the insurers would think back in London, I think it was.
Yeah.
Tell that story to listeners.
Oh, look, that was really funny. So we sat down and as a large engineering firm, we carry some pretty significant insurances. So every year they actually, we were insured. So I'm pretty sure the firm still is insured through Lloyd's of London. So the lawyers every year would fly to London and they would have a risk management meeting to talk through what the company's got coming up in terms of really big projects. And they said, okay, we're going to have to brief them on this. We have to brief the insurers on this. And they were making, we did this big briefing and they were getting really geared up going, well, this is really different and strange. And, I'm not sure the insurer is going to understand what we're doing here. And they got
with bees.
Yeah. They're like the whole briefing on the hives and everything, how are we going to manage the risk? And then they get in the room with the insurers in London and said, oh, we're doing this. And they were like, oh, yeah, like the Queen does at Buckingham Palace down the road. Oh, yeah, that's fine. It was a complete non-event. They were completely like, oh, yeah, well, and that's the thing. In London, urban beekeeping's totally been a thing for decades. In Paris, it's been a thing for, 1930s onwards. They've had hives right in the cities for decades and decades. And increasingly people are now starting to connect this to their wild. Like you said, I mean, you've picked up the main theme I wanted to get out of this was it's not about the bees, just about the bees. It's definitely not about the honey. It's about how that can be a vehicle for people to connect to the wider landscape. Yes. And think about how can I change my city in a positive way to improve the way it operates.
The book is called Urban Beekeeping, The City as a Hive. The author is Parliament's beekeeper, the head beekeeper at Parliament. His name is Cormac Farrell. It is a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. You can pick it up in New Zealand, Cormac.
You can indeed. Well, my publisher is based in New Zealand. The main editor is is based in New Zealand. It's an Australian New Zealand company.
Now, are you coming to New Zealand to promote your book?
First chance again. Any excuse. I love New Zealand. I think it's glorious. I've never been to North Island, so I'll have to try and find an excuse to get up there. Yes.
No, well, what you've got to do is reach out, let us know if you're coming.
Absolutely.
And do a series of tours, set it up with our New Zealand Parliament, because they've got wonderful parks around there.
Yeah, but it's called the beehive, but they don't have beehives.
I know.
This is a travesty. This is a travesty. We have to fix this.
Yes, you have to fix this. Otherwise, it's they're lying even about the building.
Exactly.
They say politicians got to tell the truth. If it's going to be a beehive, you've got to have bees.
Got to have beehives.
And they've got lovely balconies there. That would be fabulous. So on behalf of New Zealand, I invite you down. I think per head of population, you'd sell more books here by a factor of two if you visited.
Sounds good.
And I think that you could get sponsorship from a firm that wanted to get into it because it is you got Orcon for a start.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah.
They should fund you for a 2-week tour. And brand it. No, I'm serious.
I reckon we're onto something here.
It's such a wonderful thing. And when you're coming, come back on our show.
Will do.
Because you'll have our listeners queuing up to have your book signed.
Oh, look, it sounds fantastic. And look, thanks so much for having me on. I really enjoyed the conversation. It's been really fun. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
I love the book.
Look, that's why I wrote it. Like, I you know, we're all stuck in lockdown. There was my partner had a super intense job. I was actually still working because I was an ecologist, and being alone in a forest is about as socially isolated as you get. So we were doing heaps of infrastructure work, but we all went down, the executive, myself and others, we all went down to 60% load because to preserve income for the juniors. And I had 2 days a week plus evenings where you couldn't go anywhere or do anything to write. And I found that I loved writing. I really enjoyed it.
Well, the passion is in every page. I love the photos.
Oh, yes.
And they explained everything. And it's a sort of book that you'd leave on your coffee table and people would pick it up and skim through it because it had nuggets on every page. It's a wonderful book. It's called Urban Beekeeping by Cormac Farrell. You're on Reality Check Radio. We've had a real talk. Send us a text at 2057. Email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. If you want to learn a thing or two about bees, if you're interested in having bees in an urban or city situation, this is your book. I think they're a lot easier in a city than hens, for certain. And as Cormac found, your neighbours will love you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.